Hi, everybody. My name is Keith Carpenter, and I am an alcoholic. And I love Alcoholics Anonymous. I got sober July 20th, 1967, and I prepared those two astronauts to go to the moon in 1969 on July 20th, you know, because I always wanted to go to the moon. You know, we get to thinking these broad, wonderful things, you know. And I always thought when I was a little kid, I wanted to be Buck Rogers, you know, and go to the moon, you know. And they did it, you know, so they celebrated my birthday for me. I want to thank Eric and all the committee and everybody that is here today, you know, to support this convention. We certainly aren't saints, you know, never have been, never will be. I don't want to be a saint, you know. Who the heck wants to be perfect? Well, I don't know, maybe so. But the three speakers before me, three or four speakers, were marvelous. I've never heard Karen so good. She was, she makes me cry, you know. And I do cry because I cry with a bunch of love. I really think I love Alcoholics Anonymous. I love the people in Alcoholics Anonymous, you know. I love Dr. Bob when he stated in that convention just before he died, you know, we are made up of love and service, and that's it, you know. But love and courage, you know, love and support, love and kindness, love and, you know, I always heard God is love and love is God, you know. And I never dreamed that I would ever want to say that. Because when I was 9 years old, my dad died all of a sudden, very, very abruptly. And I loved my dad, just tremendous. And so I threw God out the window. I looked up at the ceiling in this bedroom at my grandmother's house and said, God, you are a dirty SOB, and I never will believe in you again, and I certainly won't be loving you and a lot of people. And get to this program, and if we stick around here, you know, what happens to us is we create the ability to love if we haven't had it before. You know, we create the ability. I love to love. I really do. I mean, I like hugging people and being close to people and, you know, just sharing with them, you know. And they always said, you know, if you do something a lot, you'll get something in return. So I want a lot of love in return. So I got to give a lot of love. You know, you got to give a lot. We all got to give a lot of love. Especially the newcomer that comes in. Give him a pat on the back. You know, say, God, you can make it. All you got to do is, you know, give up. You know. All we're going to do is give up, surrender. Gee, I never wanted to give up or surrender in my life, for crying out loud, you know. Because I have an ego, a fantastic ego, as we all have. I have a maniac up there that supports my ego, you know, and he directs me and gives me all this unbelievable direction that damn near killed me. You know, that damn near. And he kind of sneaks in there once in a while and wants to give me more direction. And that's why we have sponsors. That's why we have meetings. That's why we have commitments. Love and commitment, you know, is love and service. That's why we have all these things, you know. If you're new, you know, I mean, you're scheduled for a fantastic trip beyond the moon. A fantastic trip in life. Life on life's terms, you know. Because life is a bunch of ups and downs. For everybody, there is no perfection in life. I really believe that. There's no perfection in life. And we have to do a lot of things. We have to work very hard. As my friend Clint said in his talk, now, there's a lot of work to be done once you get here. But the important thing is you got to get here. You know, that's the most important thing. I believe that I've been an alcoholic since the day I swam out of my mother's womb and let out the first cry. I believe it was an alcoholic cry. I really believe that. Because as far as I can remember back, I've been different and unwanted and unloved and all the things, you know, that most alcoholics experience, you know. And I have this fantastic ego. God, I still have it. And God and sponsorship and people and wives. She just gave me direction before we came down here. And I took it. Yeah. But I was sitting up here before I got up here, I felt tremendously nervous. Tremendously nervous, you know. And I don't even know why, but I think it's because I've been, this weekend, I've been with John and Karen and Clint and Linda and John and Dory, people that I'm very close to, Pauline, and just all the, everybody on the program, KC, God, what a great talk he gave, you know. I'm close to, I guess that's why I felt nervous. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to tell you that Alcoholics Anonymous has a theme song, and I'm going to sing it to you, whether you like it or not. Maybe it'll get me settled down a little bit, okay? Talking about the ego, you know? I, me, I, me, me, I, me, I, me, and you. Feel better already. I remember in kindergarten. Remember when you were in kindergarten? My teacher, who I was kind of in love with, she was a beautiful lady. She came up to me and she said, Keithy, Mrs. Fullerton, my name is Keith. I want to be a man. Keithies are sissies, you know? And I didn't want her to call me Keithy. And she says, I know Keithy. Oh, God, I wanted to hit her, you know? She says, you've been chosen. I've been chosen. Hey, not bad. You know, you've been chosen to recite a poem. Terrible. At the Easter pageant this year. No way that this human being can get up at some kind of a podium or in front of a Easter pageant full of kids, you know, and be perfect. And I needed to be perfect. In kindergarten, I wanted to be perfect because I knew I wasn't. I knew I was unwanted, unloved. I was ugly in my head when I looked at myself in the mirror. And, you know, I knew that I couldn't get up here and recite a poem, you know. And she started away from me. And I said, wait a minute, Miss Boynton. She turned around. Yes, Keithy. Oh, God, you know. I just said, the words that Casey used them last night, Clint used them, you know, I said, but you don't understand. Famous alcoholic words. You don't understand. And when I get to Alcoholics Anonymous, I figure I understand that I don't understand because my case is different. We're all different. We're not like her, him, or them, or, you know, we're different. We feel different. So what I did is I did the next alcoholic thing that I could think of, and I took that stupid poem and I went home. And I practiced, and I practiced, and I practiced, and I practiced so I could probably get up there when the Easter pageant came along and recite that poem to perfection, because I needed to, because I knew you didn't like me already. And if I got up there and messed it up, you would dislike me more. And the Easter pageant came along, and I was invited up to the little podium, Jefferson Grammar School at East Bakersfield, California. Mrs. Fullerton standing there, you know. And I started out. I said, twinkle, twinkle, little star, how I wonder where you are. To perfection. I didn't miss a beat, you know. God, I felt good, you know. And when I got through and the pageant was over, people were coming up and patting me on the back, you know. Gee, that was good. You know, you really did good. And God, did I feel good. So what I strive to do from that moment on is to strive for perfection. Didn't know exactly how to do it. I'm young. I'm just a little tight, you know. But I said, okay, from now on, I'm going to overachieve, which I did. And if I didn't get successful overachieving, I underachieved. Then I lied for your approval. I wrote hot checks to the tune of almost going to prison. They came and got me, handcuffed me, took me to jail. And I came that far of going to prison over it. For your approval, I wrote those hot checks for you. You go into a bar that you know the bar, Potts back door next to Freeway Chevrolet in Bakersfield, California. You work a half a day and you go and drink a half a day. That's what car salesmen do, you know. And I went in there and, you know, and I'm sitting there and nobody's paying attention to me and the jukebox is blaring. you know, and they're laughing and they're dancing, you know, and I'm feeling miserable. Like, hey, Potts, rip out that checkbook, and I know I don't have any money in the checkbook, but I needed your approval so badly I wrote the check out. Hey, drinks for everybody, drinks for everybody. How many times did we do that? We didn't do it to be nice, I don't think. I didn't. I didn't do it to be kind. What I did it for is for your approval, to get you to like me. That's what I did it for. I wanted you to like me and love me and want me, you know. And I knew you didn't. I knew you didn't because of this terrible, terrible ego that I have that I could never fulfill. Because of this terrible set of emotions that God gave me that were alcoholic emotions. I believe that alcoholics create alcoholic emotions because God gave them to them. And then we can't work with these alcoholic emotions, especially those people out there in that world. They don't understand us. Never understood me. And people that I know just didn't understand me. And so I felt miserable all the time. Unless I was achieving. Unless you'd pat me on the back. Unless you'd look at me and say, hey, not a bad guy. You know? And I really strive for that because I needed it so desperately. I hadn't had a drink yet. But I most assuredly had the disease of alcoholism. Most assuredly had that. Because alcoholism is separate from drinking. I really believe that. The only time in my whole life from age 0 to age 38 when I got to this program, you know, I never ever felt calm and accepted and liked. You know, I never felt that way. Unless I was drinking alcohol. When I drank alcohol, it all disappeared. All disappeared, you know. God, what a fabulous thing alcohol is. It's a fabulous thing for us people. Alcoholics of our type, as my sponsor talks about. You know, the fabulous thing. So I set out to strive for perfection. And, you know, I became tetherball champion in the sixth grade. Anybody remember tetherball? You know, old sport, but man, I was number one. Because I did. I climbed over the fence and worked at it every night where nobody else would. You know, and I became tetherball champion. You know? I lettered in the four sports in high school. Because I always wanted to be an athlete, because athletes get approval, it's a picture in the paper, they're doing good, you know. And I loved hurting, my bones hurting, my muscles hurting from the workouts, you know. And after the game where you knock some people on their rear end and broke legs legally, you know. I mean, it was a marvelous thing. So I strive for perfection in many ways. Overachieving, underachieving, as I said, all those things, you know. And I had a dad, and that dad was the most fabulous dad that a kid could ever have. He drove a laundry truck. He'd make a lot of money. We were wealthy. It was in the Depression days, you know. But I remember my dad taking me to the mountains. We had a gold mine and a tungsten mine and a silver mine. We had claim on. He'd help me, want me to help him do the assay work and work in the mine, you know, and we cook a big pot of beans and some tomato sauce and, you know, and French bread and, you know, up there in the mountains and, you know, God, what a great thing for a kid. You know, I just loved going to the mountains because I was with my dad and I was doing something. And he taught me how to fish in those streams in the High Sierras. He says, now don't stand on the side of the stream where your shadow falls in the water because the fish will know you're there and they won't bite. That's kind of dumb, Dad, you know. So I tried it, you know, got my limit. God, what a fabulous man that was. He was just, he never drank, played the guitar, sang songs, drank a half a beer, and that's it. Was not an alcoholic. At 9 years old, I marched the Armistice Day Parade with him, November 11th, 1938, and he marched with me, and I was so proud. I just felt so proud. And that afternoon, I was throwing the football around in the front yard, and my dad came home, and two men grabbed him out of the car, and he was stumbling and falling. And my mom, who was Swedish, and all Swedes are drunks, right, John? Almost. Anyway, she said, oh, he's drinking. And he wasn't. And they laid him down on the bed, and he went into coma that instantly. And he was in the hospital down at Hasatel. Because he was a veteran for 16 days, and on the 16th day, I was praying every day. I was going to Christian Science Sunday School. I believed in God and Jesus and Mary Baker Eddy and all those good things. And I had my little gold stars for never missing Sunday School. So I was a pretty good little kid, I guess, you know, in spite of who I thought I was. Anyway, my aunt walked into the bedroom. My sister and I were sleeping together at my grandmother's house. And she said, "Kids, I got bad news for you." I'm like, "What's wrong? What's wrong?" And she said, "Your dad has just passed away. Got a tumor on the inside of the brain." They didn't even know about tumors in those days. And, you know, it got him, you know. And I had just said my prayers, you know, my Christian Science prayers. So I looked up at that ceiling and I said, "God, you're a dirty SOB. I'll never believe in you again. You're out of my life." And he was out of my life. And I started life trying to become somebody. I wanted to get a job because my mom was working the laundry for 15 bucks a week. And we didn't have any money. We were very, very poor, you know. It was during the Depression days. And so, you know, what I did is I got a job. I didn't get one job. And I didn't get two jobs. I got three jobs. Isn't that way alcoholics do things? We do things to excess. Because we need it. We need that ability to be better than you and you and you, you know. And I got three paper routes. And the guy said, "You can't handle them." I said, "You bet your sweet biffy I can." And I did. I got my first check, and I thought, "God, isn't this marvelous? I got a check. You know, I'm a man of the family now." And I took the check to little Ferris's grocery store where everybody hung out. And I said to Mr. Ferris, "Would you cash my check?" You know, and he cashed that check, and that money went out, you know, when I had 30, 40 bucks, whatever it was. And and it's wonderful, you know. And all my girlfriends and boyfriends were hanging out outside, you know. And I said, "Hey, everybody, come on. Drinks are on me. Soda pop, ice cream, whatever you want." Mr. Ferris said, "Pete, don't do that. Take that money home to your mother. You need that money to put it in the bank." I said, "Oh, no, no, don't be silly. Come on in." Boy, they came running in there, and they bought everything, and no money's left. And I started home, two blocks, and I had a tremendous, tremendous amount of guilt. You know, I felt guilty. A lot of the newcomers used to come in the Nest out in San Fernando Valley, and Mary Regan was running this at that time. She passed away recently, the last couple of years. But she used to, you know, the newcomer would think, "Why do I feel so guilty for crying out loud, Mary?" You know, and she said, "Well, son, the reason you feel guilty is because you're guilty." Not the reason. And so I'm walking home, I'm feeling tremendously guilty. So we alcoholics can conjure up the best story in the world, can't we? We have the ability to con people. That's why we make good salesmen, I think. You know? And, you know, I conjured up this fantastic story, what happened to that money, and went home and told that story to my mother, and she believed me. You know, she believed me. It was okay. It was okay to lie, you know. It was okay, like, because I got her approval, okay. It's all right that you don't have the money. And how many years that I lived with this woman that I'm married to? January 23rd, we'll be married 52 years. Not bad. And how many times did I come home and tell her a story that I conjured up to get out of trouble, you know, up all night, you know, doing crazy things, you know, spending money that we didn't have, you know. And I'd come home 2, 3, 4 in the morning, clothes ripped off and being in a fist fight or something, you know. And I'd conjure up a fantastic story and she would believe me. You know why Al-Anons or people, your mother, your father, or your friends believe you when you tell them a story that's not true? You know why they believe you? Because when I told her that, I believed that I was never going to do that again. I really secretly believed in my head that I was never going to do that again. And I'd say, "Honey, I'll never do that again." It was so sincere that she would believe me. They would believe us, you know, because we have that the ability to tell that story. You know? Anyway, my dad passed away, and I started to want it to be important, and I'm 13 years old. Remember, you're 13? Horrible age. 13 is about the worst age in the world, I think, for alcoholics especially, or all people, maybe. Anyway, I had hair that stuck straight up, cut flat. I had arms like olive oil, and Popeye, about that big around. I had acne on my face so bad that you didn't want to look at it. And I looked myself in the mirror every morning that I woke up, and there was that ugly, horrible looking face. You know? And I just knew that there was never any way in the world that I'd ever get near a girl, because I knew girls would never love me, never want me. But I really was ugly. I mean, it was terrible, you know. And I was skinny, you know. And I wanted to be an athlete. I wanted to be a football player, a basketball player. And I bought got a basket in my backyard, and I'd throw baskets till midnight when the moon was out. You know, and I'd throw the football around with everybody, play sandlot football, you know. And I became a good athlete. But every Christmas Eve at 8 o'clock, Santa Claus used to come to Uncle Pete's house, because we had my two Swedish aunts married into two Italian brothers. They had a big family. My mother had 9 sisters and 4 brothers, all Swedes, you know, some of them born in Sweden. And, Santa Claus came and brought me that present, the present that you wrote away to the North Pole, you know. Remember when I was a kid, you know, I'd write that present, and I'd get that present. God, it was marvelous. I like reading Santa Claus when I was 21, you know, because we alcoholics do that thing. That's what we do. Anyway, my girl cousins would come up to me and pull on me, you know, Keithy, come dance with me, you know, like, just pull on me, you know, get away from me, I don't want girls in my life, just get away from me, I don't like girls, you know, and I really didn't. She'd pull on me, want me to dance with her, because all the other boy cousins were fighting the Second World War, you know, I was 13 years old. I'll tell you something, you know, I got feeling so bad, and hating my cousins so bad. And they were all drinking in that house, my older parents and my cousins and my older people and my aunts and uncles, and they were dancing and they were having fun. And, you know, Santa Claus had just come and papers all over, their present papers all over, you know, and I'm just feeling terrible, you know, on Christmas Eve. So I went in and I stole a bottle of VO out of the bar in the front living room of that house. Took it back in the back bedroom, the big old house, and closed the door, went in the closet, closed the door, took that top off, you know, and I started going like this. I said, wait a minute, I'm going to be an athlete. Athletes don't drink. You know, what am I doing? And I said, screw it, you know. Just took a big old slug out of that damn bottle, and it hit my mouth, and it burned, and it hit my throat, and I coughed it, I spit it up. It was terrible. I said, how can they like that stuff? How can they like it? I remember so vividly, you know, except what happens to every alcoholic in the world. It settled down into the bottom of my tummy in that warm, wonderful, beautiful, fantastic feeling that every alcoholic in the world gets came up my back. It made my hair feel good, my toenails feel good, and everything in between. It was marvelous. It was marvelous. I took another drink, and it was hard to go down, but it went down, and another one, about 8 drinks off of that bottle, and I put it up in the closet on the shelf, and I went out and learned how to jitterbug that night. I learned how to walk. I learned how to talk. I learned how to be somebody. I learned how to be maybe that I would be okay. You know, alcohol did that for me. Did that for me. So I drank every ounce I could drink from age 13 to age 38 till I got to this program. Every drop I could. I was not a periodic drinker. I was a daily drinker, but you can't drink every day because alcoholic poisoning sets in. You just can't drink every day. But I drank as often as I could. And I had a buddy named Wino. His name was Gene Garcia. And his mother and father owned a restaurant called Joso's in East Bakersfield, a fabulous restaurant. And they made their own wine. Yeah, and he would bring a gallon of wine to his locker and my locker in the athletic department. And all through high school, 4 years, I had a bottle of wine there, a gallon of wine to sip on whenever I wanted to. Now, I lettered in 4 years in 4 sports. I became good. I became student body president. If you'd have asked me why I did all that, how could I do all that, I'd say because I have a bottle of wine in my locker. And that's why the alcohol did it for me in my head. The maniac I have up here said, the alcohol's doing it, kid. The alcohol's doing it. You know? And I really believe that. I believe that when I'm drinking, I'm doing pretty good. But when I'm not drinking, I just don't feel good most of the time. So I drank as often as I could drink. And I strived, and I got a scholarship to Stanford, and I went up there, and I ran away from there because they all had $100 bills in their pockets, and I couldn't mix in. Went back and went to Bakersfield Junior College, and thank God I did. We had two fabulous football teams. Frank Gifford was on that team. Sid Hall ended up for the Bears. Another kid ended up for the Redskins. I was drafted by the 49ers. We had a good, we beat Dixie Junior College in St. George, Utah, 96. We gave them 6 points because we didn't want them to feel bad. 96-6. We beat the next team from Mexico City, 105-0, and we didn't like them, so we didn't give them anything, you know. God, though, but we got approval. God, we got a lot of approval for being that good. God, I loved it. I loved football. God, it was the greatest sport in the world, you know. I also used to go girl watch. Any girl watchers in here? Come on, guys. Hey, man. A lot of them, you know. I used to go to East Bakersfield High School where I graduated from and girl watch. And this little girl come out of the music room, and she had long brown hair down to here. She's part Indian, Choctaw Indian. She had that beautiful olive Indian skin. She had those eyes that just sparkled and just flew at you, you know. And she was gorgeous. And she was pretty well endowed, you know. And then I liked that, you know. And I watched her come out of the music room, and she walked right in front of me. I was sitting in my mother's car that I told everybody was mine, you know. And Tommy, my buddy, Tommy Latham, was sitting next to me. We were a girl watching. And I watched this beautiful woman just walk right in front of me. I said, God, look at that. Who is that? And Tommy said, that's Sally Peters. She just moved here from Oklahoma. I said, you've got to be kidding. I haven't seen her before. And she was looking over at us, too. You know how that is. And I said, Tommy, I'm going to marry that girl. Hadn't even met her. Just saw her. What I saw was perfection in my head, you know, in my sight. And 4 months later, we were married off to San Jose State for a football scholarship. I'd never met her before I'd made that decision. You know, that's an alcoholic way, you know. That's basically it. My whole life is a series of alcoholic ways, things, you know. And I call myself a 75%er because, you know, we alcoholics, if we're good at something, we're good at it. And we do pretty good. And I call myself, I'm a 75%er. I can climb up the ladder of success about 75% of the way, and whammo, I would fail and I have to start all over. And I, what happened? And I'd make up another story. Or like the third step, you know, do this, this, and this. And there I go again. I'm making it. I'm selling a lot of cars, you know. I'm playing good football. I'm doing all these things, you know. And life is really pretty good for 75% of that time element until I fail. And, you know, I'm like, why do I fail? What am I doing, you know? And if you'd have told it was because of my alcohol intake, I'd have knocked you on your rear, you know. Anyway, I went to the 49ers, and I got up there a week early to practice. Wyatt Kittle and I were drafted the same year, and I was the center, and he was the quarterback, second-string quarterback. And I got up there with him, and we'd practice centering the ball so it would be perfect, so the lineman would be able to get 6-inch advantage on the defense. You know, if it was supposed to go on two, I wouldn't center it on two. I'd center it on of the two, you know, and that would give them 6 inches to block the and we worked hard at it, you know. We were, every morning we got up at 5 o'clock for 2 weeks in this camp, football camp, starting in July. And we would work all day till 9 o'clock at night, lights out, up 5 o'clock in the morning, over and over and over. And the third day, a little halfback named Joey Arenas, he said, hey Carp, I always like a beer. Bing, my God, a beer? How the hell are you gonna beer in this place? We're locked in the can, I can't even call my wife. He says, well, at night, he says, tonight it's a special deal. We do it every year. You know, put your pillows in your bed like you're sleeping. Come to the end of the barracks, we go down to this little bar in Redwood City, and we hoist with you. Oh, man, doesn't that sound great, you know? And I went down there, and I was sitting at this bar with Leo Navellini, you know, a fabulous tackle, you know, Frankie Albert, Ed White, you know, and all these fabulous football players, you know. And I thought, God, I'm a part of. That's why if you're new, if you're sitting in the back of the room, which when you're new, you usually do, you know, you know, if you're new and you're here, you're a part of Alcoholics Anonymous. Because when I was sitting at that bar, I was a part of that football team. And I'm a stupid rookie, 3 days, you know. No way I'm a part of anything. But by showing up, you can be a part of something. By showing up to these meetings and these conventions, you can be a part of Alcoholics Anonymous. That's just the way it is. So Joey and I sat there and drank till 3 in the morning. The bartender locked the door and let us drink till 3. Everybody else, all the great players, the Frankie Alberts and Whitey Tittles and all those guys, went back to their bed and got up the next morning by the clock in good shape. And Joey and I drank and we finally struggled home, got 2 hours sleep, and woke up the next morning, and there was a special first time ever scrimmage, you know, with pads and everything. And I'm playing linebacker, and I'm supposed to get to the quarterback, naturally. It was a lot of passing, that's what we were doing. And so, man, at first, you know, I felt horrible. I had this horrible hang-up. I hadn't drank in 3 weeks. We were locked in this stupid camp. And I took off for the quarterback, Frankie Albert, and Gino Banducci, 7 times All-Pro, hit me and drove me up in the air, and my head hit the turf, you know, boom, like that. It was like a Liberty Bell went off inside, you know, and I said, I'll never, ever drink again. I want to make this football team. I want to be a football player. I want to make money. I want to buy a house for my wife with a light. I want to buy an education for my children. I want to be a man. I want to be somebody. Why did I do that? Didn't know why I did it, but I did it. I played 5 years of football for 5 different teams and just drank myself from the 49ers to the Edmonton Eskimos to the Winnipeg Blue Bombers to the Toronto Argonauts to the Montreal Alouettes. I was good enough to play there, but I wasn't good enough to be there because of my alcoholism, my drunkenness, going to bars, staying there 3 or 4 in the morning and trying to practice the next day for a game, getting my name in the paper for being in a fist fight in a bar. You know, stupid things, you know. I just stupid things. And if you'd have told me it was alcohol was doing all that, I'd have knocked you on your head. It wasn't. It's just my case is different. Things happen to me that don't happen to those other guys. Got a couple of guys that drank quite a bit, you know, but not like me, you know. And things didn't happen to them like me. My case is different. Coach, you just don't understand. And I destroyed my career. I destroyed my career. And I went back to Bakersfield and went in the car business. And by that time we had 2 kids and another one. And, you know, I was struggling and I was trying to be somebody and trying to make a dollar. And I was drinking half a day and half a night. You know, I was a terrible, terrible drunk. And didn't realize it and just figured that, well, that's part of my life. I work. Hey, I'm working. Give me credit. You know, I'm working. You know, I'm making a few bucks. And I was the kind of salesman that I made, this was back in the late 50s. And I would make $2,800 one month selling cars. And the next month, I'd make $102. You know, I mean, you know, I was just not consistent in anything I ever did because of my alcoholism. You know, not because of anything else. And I was good. I was that 75%er and the failure and over and over and over again. You know. Finally, I said, honey, we got to move to Los Angeles, the land of milk and honey. And I was trying to run away. I was going through bankruptcy, and I was trying to run away from them that I couldn't understand, and they couldn't understand me, and I couldn't work for, and, you know, I couldn't work for them. They didn't want me to work for them, you know. Back down to L.A., and I started building swimming pools. I built Jane Mansfield's swimming pool with a big heart, with 2 little hearts in the middle of it. Big old pool. And I was good. And I was making it. I was doing good. And all of a sudden I woke up and they fired me from the job I had. I got a job in selling cars and got fired from there. And, you know, I became 320 pounds of bloke, of alcoholic bloke, you know, fat, red face, you know. Big belly, you know, not in shape. You know, I got a job selling swimming pool boilers. And I worked there and I sold more boilers than they ever sold in the history of the company. Except I got called into the office one day and Mr. Vitale, the owner, said, Keith, he says, I called you in to fire you. God, Mr. Vitale, I'm your best salesman. What do you mean, fire me? He says, you're a drunk. First time anybody had really said, you're a drunk, that was important. He says, you got hot checks all over to all my customers. He says, you're a bum. Now get the hell out of here. handed me my last check. I went home and I said, honey, quit my job. You don't tell them that you got fired again. I had 61 jobs before I got sober. 60, don't laugh. It takes a lot of work to get 61 jobs. Believe me, I would never go in the line to get unemployment. Because that people that are sissies do that. People that can't work do that, And I didn't want anybody to see me there. The ego, that ego up there. So finally went into my own business, and it lasted about 2 years. I had 75 accounts, I never forget. And I was doing the Jane Mansfield School, I was doing Marilyn Monroe School, I was doing Red Skelton School, I was fixing them and painting them and getting new heaters and everything. I was really getting successful again, I thought, this is it, I made it. I'm working for myself. I'm my own boss. God, that's the worst thing in the world for an alcoholic, But boy, at the time it felt good, It felt really good, But I'll tell you something, I was doing pretty good, and all of a sudden my little wife, who was doing the books and everything, she was getting letters in the mail. We do not want Mr. Carpenter ever in our backyard again. My lovely new wife caught him urinating in the swimming pool this morning, I don't remember urinating in the swimming pool, I didn't know what there was such a thing as blackouts. I didn't know that. And I got another letter, and I was urinating on the filter system. I mean, I was writing all these hot checks, and I was just, I was a full-blown alcoholic, drinking as much as I could drink, because when I drank, that was the only time I had any peace of mind. The only time I had any comfort is when I was drinking. That's the only time. I didn't mind getting drunk and throwing up, it was part of the deal. And the deal was good for me. And they don't understand. They just don't understand me. And the only problem with me is I've never been successful continuously, and I probably never will. So screw it. Just keep drinking, Pete. The maniacs up there telling me all this. And I'm this big, fat blob, and my lovely wife called the National Council on Alcoholism, a guy named Frank Huddleston. And I went down there. She says, I made this appointment for you. You're going to go with me. And I said, okay, just don't yell and scream. She had a horrible habit when I was hungover in the morning. You got a backbone, I can tell you this. Where's your willpower, You're an alcoholic. Oh, God, I hated that. Because I'm not an alcoholic. I'm just a guy that can't make it. Don't you understand? Anyway, came and all go, and I went down there and missed this guy for 1 hour, tell this horrible story about chasing his mother with a butcher knife. Hell, I love my mother. That's an alcoholic, That's a real alcoholic. I'm not an alcoholic. And I don't remember anything else besides drinking 9 glasses of water, And she was upstairs talking to a girl from Al-Anon, Doris Roberts. And we went home, and I kept drinking. When she went out the door with me, Frank handed her a phone number. 3 phone numbers, actually. But the one she zeroed in on, I don't know why. Richard Arlen, a famous guy that made the All-American, an actor. Another was, Mary Shirley Temple, Johnny Agar, I think his name. And, they were alcoholics at that time. They didn't stay there. But the other number she plastered all over the house. She took this number. We had one of these little guns, that you can make numbers for identifying parts. And she'd peel it off, 392-2636, 293-2636, and she put it on the mirror, she put it on the refrigerator, right over the refrigerator, she put it on the hall phone, she put it in the mirror in the bathroom, in the bedroom. I mean, my God, I saw this stupid number. I said, why in the hell is she doing this to me? Alcoholics Anonymous, I'm never going to call Alcoholics Anonymous. 9 months later, July 19th, I'd been drinking for 3 weeks, I couldn't get drunk and couldn't get sober. Johnny talks about that. I could just limbo, getting limbo, but just nothing was happening. Nothing. And I kept drinking and drinking. 3 solid weeks. So one day I said, screw it, I need to go to Bakersfield and get some good Basque food. They had some tremendous Basque restaurants. I grew up with all those kids in the Basque families, Anyway, I went to Bakersfield in this big old truck I had. Didn't have a straight fender in it. Both bumpers were wired up, But I'd never hit anything, It's just an alcoholic truck, You see them all the time, right? And I went to my favorite Basque restaurant, the Wool Growers Cafe. And John Pierre was the owner of it. And, "Hi, Keith, been seeing you in a long time." Yeah, I went in, I had this meal, and I threw up all over the table. Because there's a bottle of wine in front of you at those Bass Fest, and I drank two or three of those bottles. You know? And John Pierre says, "Keith, get out of here. You know, you've done this before, and get the hell out of here." And they threw me out of the bar, place that I loved, and I'd been so many times. You know? And I got in this truck, and I drove home, and the next morning I got up, and I had the worst hangover I think I've ever had in my whole life. The worst hangover, and I rolled out of bed. I couldn't get out of bed and stand. I couldn't stand up. And I just fell on the floor right next to the bed. I said, "My God, what's wrong with me?" And I tried to get up. I couldn't get up. So on my all fours, I crawled into the porcelain altar. Remember that porcelain altar? Ooh, my God, that cold porcelain felt so good, you know? Oh, it was wonderful, you know? And I felt that porcelain, and I lifted up the seat, you know? And I said, "Oh, man," and I threw up, and I threw up good. I mean, I was really giving it my best. And guess what? I looked down at the porcelain, and there's 3922666. I don't know how you got here, but I got here officially through the toilet bowl. You know? And I said, "Oh, my God, maybe I better call ANA." You know? And I was sore. I couldn't even talk, pardon me, you know? So I splashed some water in my face, and I got up finally and walked into the hallway, 17 steps. I could not remember that phone number, naturally, you know? And I looked, the number was right above there where she put it, you know? And I called that number, and I straightened. We alcoholics, well, we get official real good, don't we? You know? And I straightened up, you know, and I said, the man answered the phone. I says, "Sir, is this where I'm supposed to call if I have an alcohol problem? You know, like a doctor, you know?" And 5 minutes before, I was dying, and I couldn't even talk. And he says, "Well, let me ask you a question. Are you an alcoholic? Do you think you have a problem?" "I don't have a problem. My wife's divorcing me. My kids hate me, and I just can't make it in life." He says, "Wait a minute, kid. You're an alcoholic." Then I get mad. I say, "Who the hell are you? You know? Do you know me?" And it was Clancy, for Christ's sake. You know? You know what he said very gently? He says, "Keith, I know you, but I don't know you. I know you because you are an alcoholic." And I started to talk a little bit, and all of a sudden the phone hung up. And I thought, "My God, what is he doing to me?" You know? I said, "Who is this guy?" I went out in my pickup truck, my old alcoholic pickup truck, a year and a half old woman, and the woman's going to speak a little later, she took all these half-quarts bottles, cans of beer, and only bought two cans. I was only on to drink two in the morning, and then it was two, till it was 40 a day, you know. But she took all these, and put them underneath the seat, and threw them in the back of the pickup. She'd take them out of the paper sack, and she'd pour the excess beer on the seat. Then she'd pyramid them, so when I opened the door, they would all fall on me. Bing, bang, bong, bong, you know, I'd kick in those stupid cans. I said, I'm gonna divorce that woman. I hate her. And I did. I hated her. You know? And I got in that truck, I went, squish, oh, God, you know. And I go down to the local liquor store, and I bought one half a quart of beer and one pack of cigarettes. I was smoking 3 to 4 packs of Salem cigarettes in those days, you know. And I lit that first cigarette, took a big drag. I popped that, about one can. I don't know why. I've never bought one can in my life. And I popped that can and put the cold can up my head, and I took that first drink. And I took another drag off that cigarette, and the cigarette smoke went and hit the wrong pipe, you know. And I coughed, and I started popping and spitting it up, trying to take another drink, and I went, man, I just vomited all over the windshield. I couldn't see where I'm going. You know what the maniac said? "Turn the windshield wipers on, dummy." Which I did, you know. You know, I stopped the truck. I remember getting my arm up there and wiping this vomit off the damn windshield so I could see. And I got home, and then I remembered Clancy. He said, "Hey, I'm going to work. I'm just shaving. I'll call you later, kid." And I stared at the phone, and I knew he would not call. I knew that nobody really wanted to help me, you know, I just knew I was a loser, and I was never going to be a winner as long as I live, you know. Then the phone rang, and he talked to me for about an hour, and he sent a guy named Bob Wilson to do a 12-step call on me, And they took me to my first side meetings. The first night, Bob says, "See the man that's going to speak?" And I said, "Yeah." "Well, that's Clancy, that's the guy you talked to today." I said, "Oh." And I went over and shook hands with him, you know. And Bob says, "Ask this man to be your sponsor." I said, "Sponsor? What's a sponsor? Do we sponsor Little League here, you know?" I didn't know what a sponsor was. But for some reason, I said, "Clancy, would you be my sponsor?" I said, "I don't know what it is, but I'll do it." He says, "Will you do everything that I ask you to do? Everything." And I said, "I'll try." "No, don't try. You do everything, commit to doing everything I say, and I will sponsor you." And I did, and 33 and a half years later, he's still my sponsor. 52 years with this woman, you know. I have peace of mind, you know. I joined the Pacific Group. It was the best thing for me. I fell in love with Alcoholics Anonymous the very first day. Oh, I thought maybe in 2 weeks I might drink one beer, you know. But that went away real quick. And I got active. I got involved. Every meeting. I went to 14 meetings a week my first 2 years in Alcoholics Anonymous because I loved it. I loved being a part of it. I loved having those people slap me on the back and say, "God, geez, you're doing good. You know, you're a newcomer doing good." And I loved it. It just engulfed me, and I started doing everything I could in Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm a true believer that a newcomer can walk in here, not know anything about what it is or what he's doing, and if he does it, he can become successful. Be a part of. Took panels to every prison there was. You know, started a meeting called the Woodland Hills Action Meeting, and we took action. We used to go to Tasby State Prison, 30, 40, 50 of us at a time. It was unheard of, but we went there. The only group they ever allowed the women to go into the maximum side of the prison because we were so structured and so good. And God, it was a good feeling. Good feeling. And a year, just short of a year, I sat in these damn seats and my back hurt. You know, and the speaker was up there when he was talking, you know. One drunk talking to another drunk, which is what I do. I'm not a speaker, I'm a talker. And I would say, you know, "What's happening? You know, what's happening?" And what was happening was that I was not believing in God, and they were telling me to believe in God, and I hated them for doing it. My sponsor was the only one who said, don't worry about God, just sit in the meeting, listen, and go home. You know? And but everybody else was talking about God this, God that, you know. So I called Clancy up. I said, "I'm going to Saudi Arabia. I got a job making $20 million, you know, and I'm going to make that money, come back, and if you want a loan, I'll give you one, you know. But I hate AA, and I hate you, and I just want to tell you about it." And he says, "Would you come down to my office and have one cup of coffee?" "Not two, not three, one cup of coffee." And I said, "Well, okay, you know." And I went down to his office downtown. And I walked to his office, and I said, "What do you want to tell me?" Not, "Hello, Fancy, how are you?" "What do you want to tell me?" He says, "See that door you just came in?" He said, "Once you've got that door, I want you to take the third step, son." I said, "I told you I was never going to believe in God." He says, "Do it." And I started out the door, and I turned around, I said, "Clancy, tell me how to do it. I don't know how to do that. I'll try, but I don't know how to do that." He says, "I can't tell you, Keith. It's one of the steps that you just have to have an honest desire to do it. And if you do, you will probably do it. You will complete the step." He says, "Now get the hell out." And he says, "Don't call me or don't go to an AA meeting until you've taken the third step." Pretty severe. Although I was not going anyway, so it didn't matter. And I'm driving down the freeway in my old beat-up truck. And it came out this way, and I'm so grateful that it came out the way. God was directing me. The maniac had disappeared for a while. And I said, "Maybe I should accept the seemingly bad things that happened to me as well as the good things that happened to me as necessary for my growth, you big dumb Swede." And I said that over and over that day, and I was trying to make it perfect, and you know, I was just saying it over and over. And I went home, and that night I got on my knees for the first time since I was 9. And I said, okay, I'll put it in the form of a prayer, and I'll get on my damn knees, you know, and I'll say it and see what happens. And I said, dear God, as I understand, please help me to accept the seemingly bad things as well as the good things as necessary in my growth. Amen. Amen. And I said, okay, I'll say it for 3 weeks. Then I'll think about it. And 2 weeks later, I was in this nest, and I had a knife stab me in the heart, I thought, and I was having a heart attack. And that seemed to be bad, you know. And what I did is I got up, and then I passed out right on the table where we were sitting. And then I got up, and I said, leave me alone. They were trying to help me, and I took 3 steps, and I passed out. And the next thing, I'm in an ambulance, roaring to the hospital, sweating, you know, profusely, and my heart is killing me. I'm dying. I am absolutely, in my head, I'm dying, you know. And I said, dear God, please help me accept the seeming bad thing. This is my good. What am I doing this for? Why am I saying that? I was going crazy, you know. I get to the hospital, and Mary was working there, and they wheeled me in on the gurney, and she grabbed my hand, you know. She happened to be right there. You know, one of the little seconds and inches, you know, that happened in my, life, I think. Anyway, I got out of the hospital 4 days later, and you know what it said on the medical report for the insurance company? Obesity and irritable bowels. Ooh, gas escaped out of my ribcage. But the prayer got me through. I became a little bit of a believer. 2 weeks later, our daughter, Kim, beautiful, gorgeous young girl, 19 years old. And she comes to Sally and I. We didn't even know she was into drugs or anything. She was a perfect kid. And she says, Dad, Mom, I'm going to move out to Joe in his house. Joe was sitting at the kitchen table with a hat on, with the dingleberries hanging out, and a hog motorcycle, and a known doper. You know what I did? I grabbed Joe by the back of the neck and seized the pants and threw him through the plate glass window. I went insane. We can go insane in Alcoholics Anonymous, especially if we don't have God in our life, you know? And I certainly didn't have God in my life. I threw him out, and I counseled my daughter by yelling and screaming and hollering. I spanked her. Put her on my knee. She's 19 years old. I slapped her in the face. I went totally insane. The maniac had taken over, you know? And she moved out the next day anyway. And I went to Clancy. I said, well, I need to write about it. And I wrote about it. It was like 1,000 pounds off my shoulders. And 2 weeks later, we got a call from the hospital in Santa Monica. And that attendant said, would you please come to the hospital? We think we have your daughter here at the hospital, and she's in bad shape. And they didn't know her name because she was on a dope run with this kid, and they turned the car over and had no identification. And she had hit the pavement. They had operated on her 7 times that night and had 384 stitches across her face, you know. And she was in intensive care. And the doctor, when we met him, said, Mr. and Ms. Carpenter, your daughter's in intensive care and she probably will not live. So the thing we provide for people like you is the chapel. And you can go to the chapel and pray to the God of your understanding. What a beautiful set of words, you know. And we went down there. I called Clancy. He was there in 5 minutes. Sally and myself and Fancy got on our knees and prayed to the God of our understanding. I had a God that I didn't even know I had. Didn't even know I had him. And she came out of intensive care 3 weeks later. And then she came out of the hospital. And she started going to the Pacific group and then disappearing. And then she started, she gained up to 200 and some odd pounds. She was fat and ugly. And for 17 years, that little lady drank and used in this life. And she never made it. And she says, screw it, I'm moving to Pony, Montana. And she married a guy, and they went to Pony, Montana, and she found AA in Pony, Montana, a town of 60 people. And I thought, why couldn't she find it in the Pacific group in Los Angeles, you know? It doesn't matter where you find it, as long as you find it. You know? I think I've talked too long. I'm going to stop this thing. But I just want to tell you that I really love you. I want to tell you that I really love my wife. I want to tell you that I was asked to do a marathon for the first ever marathon for the International Convention in 1980. And I went over there and we set the Chuck Nesbitt and I set the chairs up and the 3,000 chairs and we had flags from every country and it was a marvelous thing. What a pleasure, you know, to do something like that for Alcoholics Anonymous. It was unbelievably good. We had big book covers. In fact, the guy that designed this big book cover was a guy from our group. And he robbed three banks. You know, he robbed three banks because he had an alcoholic fix his car and he robbed the bank and the car wouldn't move. Anyway, Cy Goldman, and he later on served a little time and became treasurer of the Pacific Group. We had these big book covers all over. We handed them to people as they came in the 3,000 seats, you know. And a guy walking down the street named Pete, you know, he went up to this guy and he saw the white badge. He said, what is that badge, you know? And he stunk, you know. He stunk because he hadn't taken a bath in 3 weeks. He had done everything he could to not go to the bathroom in the right place. You know, and he was terrible. Beard, you know, no shoes. And Bill said, well, this is Alcoholics Anonymous. What the hell is Alcoholics Anonymous? He said, would you like to know? He says, yeah, he said, I'd like to know anything, you know. And they took him into the marathon meeting and they grabbed me and told me, Pete wants to know about AA. I went up the podium, stopped the meeting. I said, anybody here in New Orleans like to take Pete to the clubhouse and clean him up? He needs AA. 20 people come running down there, folks. One drunk helping another drunk. 20 people come running, grabbed Pete, took him to the clubhouse, shaved him, showered him, bought new clothes at the Salvation Army, shoes, you know, brought him back to that meeting. That was a Thursday night. Brought him back Friday morning, and he sat in the front row till Sunday morning. People would take him to their room and feed him. People would take him to the room and let him sleep a couple hours. And Pete just fell in love with Alcoholics Anonymous. Who wouldn't? And then Sunday morning, I was to take the candle to the Superdome and take it and put it on the dais, you know, and tell the story about the very first marathon ever, you know. And it was a fabulous thing. So I said, Pete, we're going to the Superdome. He said, not me. He said, I'm not going. Yes, you are. We took him and shoved him in the cab. I put the candle, it was that big and that big around, weighed a ton, put it on his lap so he wouldn't move. Chuck's sitting here, I'm sitting there. Cabby, take us to the Superdome. We went over there, got him in the bottom place there, and the whole Pacific group was sitting right down about where Pauline's sitting. Their whole group was there. We sat Pete down, I took the candle, and took it up to the dais, and then they asked me to tell the story, and I told a story about first ever marathon, and how it happened, and what we did in Southern California, and how we, you know, operated the marathon. And the most important thing is the newcomer in the group, that convention, would blow the candle out, the newest drunk. And I said, Pete, would you please come up to blow out the candle? Pete got up and started running. He didn't have to go up those stairs. 40,000 people staring at him, you know. He was scared to death, for Christ's sakes, you know. And Clancy tackled him. Stopped him cold. Got him going up these stairs. There were 63 stairs. It was really up there high, you know. Got him up there, you know, and I said, this is Pete. And I told him the story about Pete. And I said, this has got to be the newest newcomer here. And I said, Pete, would you blow the candle out? And he did it. My name is Pete. I think I'm an alcoholic. He blew the candle out, and I got to tell you something. There's a lot of people in this room probably were there. There wasn't a dry eye in that place. There was not a dry eye in that 30, 40,000 people. And I don't tell that story for any gratitude to me. I tell that story because, you know, one drunk helping another drunk. That's the theme song. Bill Wilson and Dr. Bob, you know, working together. Bill helping Bob, you know. That's where it started out, you know. And I got to tell you something, you know. I love it. I love every minute of it. I love Alcoholics Anonymous. I love people. I love my fellow man. And if you do all that, you don't have time to get ornery. You don't have time to get resentful. You don't have time to be that person you don't want to be. If you love your fellow man, and love every person that comes through that door. Doesn't matter whether they're black, brown, pink, purple, you know, tall, skinny, fat, whatever. You love them. And if you love them enough, they'll get loved into being what we are today, most of us, happy, joyous, and free. Chuck Chamberlain, my great-grand sponsor when he was alive, used to say in his talk almost every time, he'd say, you know, if you really believe in the Lord's Prayer, if you really believe in the Lord's Prayer, and you believe in the first two words of the Lord's Prayer, Our Father, we're God's kids.